friends, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward Live, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you find me on stage at the Backyard Comedy Club in Bethnal Green. I'm braced at the mountaintop of our second ever live show. Skis waxed, visor huffed with condensation, and one piece lycra bodysuit being swallowed by my own arctic crevice with each moment. Awaiting the alpine horn of destiny to be sounded so I can ski directly through 15 slalom gates worth of trivia, leaving an increasingly mangled silhouette in each like some sort of kosher Wile E. Coyote. Bethnal Green is, of course, famous for boxing rather than alpine skiing, although that does beg the question in my mind as to why there aren't more martial arts at the Winter Olympic Games. Who wouldn't enjoy watching taekwondo on ice? And with me in the green corner is this podcast's very own undisputed champion of heroic failure. Weighing in at £150, or €130, thanks to his Irish passport. He is London Theatre's premier bat pervert.
That is only a joke if people know about a play I wrote 2 years ago.
Absolutely, and I'm enjoying it without that context. A one-man golf trivia encyclopedia set to constant broadcast, and the finest co-host available in his price range. Please welcome Barry McStay!
That pervert, Adam West, turned that role down. First things first, obviously if you're listening to us at home, thanks for listening, you probably know who we are, but we definitely know we have some people in this room who don't know about this podcast. So on Worst Foot Forward each week, we are usually joined by a single guest, and we dive into a topic on the world's worst something, whether it's baker or board game or emperor or explorer, vending machine, yeah, really, or ghost. And we celebrate heroic failure and the depths to which the inhabitants of this little blue and green marble can sink. So if you want to know the sort of thing we're into, we like the story of Robert Liston, a 19th century London medic who liked to show off his skill with a blade in public displays of speed surgery. Not on ice, sadly. But no. Culminating in one occasion where his flamboyance and speed saw him lop off the fingers of an assistant who died of infection and the hem of a coat of an onlooker who died of fright. And the patient died too, giving him surgery's only 300% mortality rate. So, as we say, normally we have one guest on the show, but we're joined by three guests because what is a live show without lots more expense than is necessary? Yeah.
And also, who knows, we may also have a 300% mortality rate by the end of the show.
All of our guests this week were on the show before during our first 18 months of recording. Our first guest is a comedian and YouTuber whose videos have about 126 million views, which is about the population of Japan. And leads me to wonder if we should have booked Osaka rather than Bethnal Green. Musician, map man, and the utterly marvellous Jay Foreman, everybody.
Hello.
Our second guest, by contrast, is an Australian comedian and YouTuber. Who is famed for her paper puppetry routines and songs, and who has also recently published her first children's book, Horror Heights, The Slime, aimed at ages 8 and above. And to those kids who are listening now to hear their new favourite author, fuck me if you tuned into the wrong programme. Please welcome Beck Hill. And Beck, if you're wondering, your YouTube views by country size is Mauritania.
I prefer having the population of Mauritania than Lesser-tania. Yeah. Sorry, fewer-tania.
And our final guest has a degree in experimental pathology, a master's in forensic science, and a PhD in viral bioinformatics, and has worked as an IT forensic investigator for the Serious Fraud Office, and for some reason she then became a comedian, and has a YouTube channel, Brunei, if you're wondering. And
So only men watch my channel. Yeah.
But don't worry, recently you've been killing it on old media, like appearing on BBC's Have I Got News For You just a couple of nights ago. How the mighty have fallen and oh so fast. Give it up for Rialina, everybody. Now, with three guests and with the bequest of a lot of our Patreon donors, we are putting on tonight a literary salon in the style of the 18th century literary salons, where great minds would get together and read their latest compositions and works to one another. But over the course of 220-odd episodes, we found a lot of lesser literary works, which we're going to share with you tonight in the company of our guests.
And like any good literary salon, if you just look underneath your chairs, you'll find just a little nubbin of opium taped there, so you can, can really get into
help you get through it all. We are also going to have an element of competition to this, and award points, some of them determined by our lovely audience here. And there will be a prize at the end of it. What prize could a show about failure give than a wooden spoon with the letters WFF written in it, because it's not big enough to write the name of the podcast?
We are going to start with cartoons, which is about the level that we're at. So we talked about the world's worst TV cartoon with award-winning writer Toby Wilson. And the winner was a cartoon called Bible Man, which is so often the case in this show that the winners are often either Nazis or evangelical Christians. And Bible Man is exactly what you think it is. You don't have to go and watch it. Some of the other things we talked about on that show were cartoons including Mr. T, Chuck Norris's Karate Commandos, The Osmonds, Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling, MC Hammer in Hammer Man, who I presume, if not Bible Man's nemesis, then certainly Jesus's. There have been some truly great, iconic people who have voiced cartoons. So Captain Planet has included the voice talents of Martin Sheen, Jeff Goldblum, LeVar Burton and Whoopi Goldberg, because sometimes you've got to do what's needed to pay the mortgage. One of my most hated adverts is the advert involving the yellow and the red M&M. And one of them is one of the most iconic actors in Hollywood. There's a lady in the front row nodding as though you know this fact. Either that or you hold a candle for one or both of the M&Ms. I am. It's the yellow one.
Are you the woman who is always in bed with them in those ads? Yeah. Are you trying to eat them or shag them? I don't know. It's such a confusing branding decision. And then we've got a shop dedicated to it.
Yeah, that shop is an M&M brothel. That's how it... Anyway, the yellow M&M, your betrothed, is voiced by J.K. Simmons, which will really put you off him a bit. And my other favourite part from cartoons is this, Orson Welles. Orson Welles, one of the greatest auteurs in Hollywood history. The final role that he played on screen was doing voice work for Transformers the movie, where he played a planet-sized Transformer, hell-bent on ultimate power, called Unicron. Or he played a dyslexic unicorn. I don't know. And his final words on screen were, "Destiny, you cannot destroy my destiny!" Which is a pretty good way to go out, if I'm honest. Anyway, our challenge for you, our panel members, for the first round to discuss is this. We have got six cartoons with famous people who were the inspiration for the cartoon. There have been some iconic people throughout history whose lives have been turned into cartoons. One of these six synopses that me and Barry are going to give you is a fake, and you have to work out which one is the fake cartoon.
There's a point for the correct answer.
So the first one is from 2003 and 2004, and it is called Stripperella.
Emma Watson.
It's that one, and it was mine. Yeah.
Have you done cartoon voice work? You must have done.
I thought you were going to ask something else. I've done video games. I mean, I'm a lot of non-playable characters in Mass Effect Andromeda.
Nice.
And Anthem. So if you hear an annoying nasal Australian, that's this guy.
I play Perun in Xenoblade 2.
Whoa.
Perun, which is really hard to get, apparently. So I bought it for my kids, but they can't get me.
Your kids can never get me.
And now I may be wrong on this. Obviously, you two have been in computer games. Jay, haven't you voiced instructional videos for like Microsoft Excel or something like that?
Even worse, I was the voice of the O2 guru about 10 years ago. So if you bought O2 broadband at some time in like 2015 and a half, I was the voice that said, "And it's as easy as that. You're now connected to Wi-Fi." So most. I pissed off so many people.
Yeah, absolutely.
It wasn't that easy, was it?
No.
It wasn't that easy.
Just hearing you say that, about half of the room started getting hackles, right? How easily they turn. Anyway, focus, Stripperella. created by Stan Lee. The main character, voiced and based upon Pamela Anderson, is a stripper named Erotica Jones, who secretly works as crime-fighting secret agent Stripperella. It also features WWE owner Vince McMahon as Dirk McMahon, the owner of Silicones, the main competitor to Tenderloins.
Correct.
Yeah. Look, one of two things has happened with this. This is either real or has come from our diseased minds. Stripperella was cancelled after one series amidst a lawsuit filed by a stripper who said it was all her idea.
Or is the imposter Camp Candy from 1989 to 1992, a cartoon starring John Candy as himself running a summer camp who has to constantly protect it from the evil developer Rex DeForest. And Candy sung the Camp Candy theme tune himself in a duet with Harry Nilsson.
Ooh. How did that go?
Can't DeForest if DeForesting is without you.
Or it could be Class of 3000, an Emmy award-winning American animated comedy series created and executive produced by Andre 3000 Benjamin of Outkast. He also played one of the characters, Sonny Bridges, who becomes a music teacher in Atlanta after quitting a hugely successful international music career. It had a one-hour special in 2006, preceded by musical performances including Andre 3000, yeah, and Chris Brown. Good pantomime work, everyone.
Yeah. Or is it Wishlist starring Macaulay Culkin? And yes, that is its full title. Which originally aired on NBC in the early 90s. The premise of the show was that Macaulay Culkin's character Nick owned a baseball glove that was hit by a shooting star. When punched three times, it allowed him to wish for anything.
That's so American, isn't it? Because that's probably been ripped from... Remember the Queen's nose?
Yes. Yes.
Remember, you just had to rub it three times? That's all you need. You don't have to punch it. That's so American. To be like, we're going to do the same thing, but bigger. Whack, whack, whack.
I think what I love about that idea is that the show is called Wish Kids starring Macaulay Culkin, but he plays a character not called Macaulay Culkin.
It's a really needy title, isn't it? Or your penultimate choice, is it Captain Planet in the 21st Century? A short-lived run of six 50-minute episodes on Cartoon Network, co-produced and co-starring Al Gore as Mr. Chairman, the Charlie or M to Captain Planet, voiced by Jimmy Fallon. Captain Planet faces up to the climate crisis with other voice actors including Jaden and Willow Smith, Steve Carell, LeVar Burton, who clearly has an agent with a one-track mind, and the guest appearance by Greta Thunberg.
A lot of love for Greta in the room.
Yeah, it's like that. I love that because you're like, that is very plausible but also bullshit. Yeah. That one.
We all want to watch it now.
Yeah.
Or was it The Governator, co-created by Arnold Schwarzenegger and Stan Lee again, and starring Arnie as himself? The story would have been that after leaving the governor's office, Arnold decides to become a crime fighter and builds a secret high-tech crime-fighting control center under his house, featuring his non-actor family members' voices as well. Cancelled before airing in 2011 because of the emerging scandal around Arnie's love affair and fathering of a child with his housekeeper.
Which should have been a plot point.
Yeah.
So, guys, which of these do we think might be a fake? Jay, well, what do you reckon?
Can I congratulate you for making all six of them just as batshit plausible? My pencil hovered over Camp Candy only because when you read that the evil developer is called Rex DeForest, you were so proud of yourself, like it was a joke. And that's all I've got to go on because they are equally batshit. So I reckon it's Camp Candy.
Thank you.
Beck, what are you thinking?
I'm going to go Stripperella.
Somehow we knew it would come to this.
I believe it was a real thing, but it never actually was animated. I reckon it would have been a comic strip.
Oh, I like it.
It should have been a comic Stripperella, actually.
Yeah, it should have been. I like it that you're calling us on a subtle red herring. Nice, yeah. Okay. You may be attributing more intelligence to us than we have, but thank you. Rhea, what do you reckon?
Do you know what? I was leaning towards Stripperella, but only because her name is Erotica Jones, and Stanley always alliterates his main characters' names. So I was like, no, sorry, no. No.
Can I get nerdy for a second as well?
Please do.
No, not the place. Not the place.
Jessica Jones is a Marvel one, and I don't think he'd come up with Erotica Jones and Jessica Jones. I think that is the mind of someone who went, this sounds like Jessica Jones. It's Erotica Jones.
And also, if you've seen Jessica Jones, I mean, it's pretty close. It's pretty close to what this is.
So two for Stripperella, one
Can I change my answer now? Because those both sounded really clever.
Well, this is the Monty Hall problem, because, you know, the game theory says that you shouldn't go for the same answer as
No, the Monty Hall problem says if you have the opportunity to change your answer, you should.
To the answer that everyone else has, which you shouldn't do.
Oh, no, that's two problems. Yeah.
I really want John Candy and Harry Nilsson to have sung a duet together, which is why I don't want to vote for that one.
I can imagine John Candy and Harry Nilsson at 3 a.m. on the 15th bottle of wine, both in their dressing gowns, bashing it out together, the song together. I'm so sorry for that mental image that I've just detonated.
That was in Stripperella, actually. Yes. You're really confusing them now.
Jay, last minute, last chat.
Oh, I'll stick with Camp Candy.
Stick with Camp Candy. Should have gone for Captain Planet in the 21st century. That was the red herring. The rest of those are all real. Oh. Yes.
Oh, my word.
So proud.
So you're saying it was Captain Planet in the 21st century. So when you read it out and said this was fake, literally said it in the middle of the script.
Yeah.
Okay, so for the rest of these competitions, folks.
Like lying directly to your face while smiling is the mood of 2021. So we talked reasonably recently about the world's worst horror story with Jessica Law, and it was written by Bram Stoker. Not Dracula, but Bram was a bit of a one-hit wonder. When he wasn't doing vampire stories, he did a lot of really over-the-top, melodramatic, romantic stories. But one time, he had a go at mashing together horror and romance in a story called The Lair of the White Worm. And it is staggeringly appalling. The plot revolves around an ancient monster which intermittently emerges from its cavern in Derbyshire Hills to feed on humans, and in the film version is hunted down by Peter Capaldi and Hugh Grant. Which is a hell of a buddy cop movie, isn't it? Capaldi, playing an archaeologist, at one point runs around a country house playing bagpipes to ward off a chasing policeman who has been turned into a toothy snake vampire. And Hugh Grant, at the time just 28 years old, he has lines like, "Put your bicycle clips on, I'm expecting company." And he ends one brief worm-slaying scene by falling over a drum kit. But the bit we're going to read is a part where at one point there is a plot twist centering around a mongoose and a pair of earplugs.
Now, mongoose is objectively the funniest animal name going, so... we've taken an extract from the Lair of the White Worm, as Ben said. In this scene, Richard Salton is bringing Adam, an Australian and Salton's only living relative, to make him heir to his estate. Now, Ben is going to play Salton. I'm going to play Adam, despite the fact we do actually have an Australian on the panel. Jay is going to play another character called Ross, and Rhea is going to provide the narration.
I think we ought to be moving.
Mr. Salton said to Adam,
"I have some things to do in Liverpool, and I am sure that both Mr. Caswall and Lady Arabella would like to get underway for Castro Regis."
"Oh, I too, sir, would like to do something."
"Dad?"
Already better than the Bram Stoker version.
"I want to find out where Ross, the animal merchant, lives. I want to take a small animal home with me, if you don't mind. He's only a little thing and be no trouble."
"Of course not, my boy. What kind of animal is it that you want?"
"A mongoose."
"A mongoose? What on earth do you want it for?"
"To kill snakes."
"Good."
The old man remembered the mound of stones. No explanation was needed. Yes, it was. When Ross heard what was wanted, he asked,
"Do you want something special, or will an ordinary mongoose do?"
"Dad?"
"Sorry, Papa."
I thought we were just doing accents.
"Well, of course I want a good one, but I see no need for anything special. It is for ordinary use."
"I can let you have a choice of ordinary ones. I only act because I have a stock in a very special one which I got lately from Nepal. He killed a king cobra that had been seen in the Raja's garden. But I don't suppose we have any snakes of the kind in this cold climate. I dare say an ordinary one will do.
Later on in the novel, with the mongoose happily killing snake after snake on the estate...
The mongoose had by this time become accustomed to him and was willing to let himself be handled freely.
Ooh. I hope they had a safe word. Okay.
Adam lifted him up and put him on his shoulder and walked on. Presently, he saw a lady advancing towards him and recognized Lady Arabella. Hitherto, the mongoose had been quiet, like a playful, affectionate kitten. But when the two got close, Adam was horrified to see the mongoose, in a state of the wildest fury, with every hair standing on end, jump from his shoulder and run towards Lady Arabella. It looked so furious and so intent on attack that he called a warning.
Look out! Look out! The animal is furious and means to attack! Seriously, why did Christopher Lee not do films with this, like playing the mongoose?
Adam rushed forward with his stick, the only weapon he had. But just as he got within striking distance, the lady drew out a revolver and shot the animal, breaking his backbone. Not satisfied with this, she poured shot after shot into him until the magazine was exhausted. I'm so tired, said the magazine. There was no coolness or hauteur about her now. She seemed more furious than even the animal, her face transformed with hate and as determined to kill as he had appeared to be. Adam, not knowing exactly what to do, lifted his hat in apology and hurried on to Lesser Hill.
The Lair of the White Worm, ladies and gentlemen.
I liked it.
Yeah. I'm not convinced that our performance was what Stoker had in mind. When Jay was the guest on the show back in episode 3, we talked about the world's worst Beatles song. Now, me and Jay are enormous Beatles nerds, and if we're not careful, we will unload all of the Beatles trivia in the world at you and bore you to tedious death with it, so we won't do that. But we had a lot of fun sort of deciding what it would be. It had to be a Ringo song. It had to be a Ringo song. I adore Ringo, but it had to be a Ringo song, and it was called Don't Pass Me By from the White Album, which I love as an album, but it's full of pointless songs, and this is the most pointless of all.
My favourite thing about this song is Ringo was pitching it since 1962, and the White Album was released in 69. So just every year they do an album, and go, can I do my song? And they go, no, Ringo.
The only place where it was released as a single was in Scandinavia, where it did peak at number one in Denmark, but miscredited to Lennon and McCartney. You know?
Maybe that's because they weren't paying attention to the lyrics.
Yeah, maybe.
I've brought along a discussion of the world's worst Beatles, so could we do by vote, by way of a cheer? If your favourite Beatle is Paul, give me a cheer. Yeah. Ringo. Yeah. George. Yeah. John. Yay! Oh, really? Oh, you guys will love this. This is this is a song I've written about everyone's favourite Beatle. Can you hear that all right with the microphone where it is?
Yeah.
Jolly good.
What if John Lennon were still alive today and he had not been shot? The general consensus is that that would be nice, but I dare to say that it might not. He'd hang around with Bono doing Live Aid and the like. Oh, I'm glad John Lennon died. Now, before you start to boo me and say that I'm a cunt, perhaps I should explain. He last wrote a good song in 1971, and he never sang a decent thing again. His music in the 80s would have sounded like Crowded House. Oh, I'm glad John Lennon died. And by the way, I wonder if he made a guest appearance as a panelist on Nevermind the Buzzcocks. All his contributions would be painfully bad, and to see him look so past it would be really sad. He'd always be on Twitter making really racist jokes. Oh, God, John Lennon died.
Yeah,
imagine if he, instead of Neil Buchanan, presented Art Attack? Cried John Lennon died. And by the way, I wonder, did you ever stop to think about whatever would have happened to McCartney? Everyone would still be saying Paul is dead, and they would have named the airport after him instead. In 1990, Yoko would have killed him anyway. I'm glad John Lennon died.
Did you know? Today would have been John Lennon's 81st birthday.
Oh, God, it would. This is what he would have wanted.
Except it's not, because it's the 9th of October, which was yesterday. Oh.
Then we talked about the world's worst playwright with playwright Artie Maddox, and we decided the world's worst playwright was Steve Bannon, who, yeah, that one, Donald Trump's advisor. In the early 90s, he wrote The Thing I Am, a rap musical inspired by Coriolanus, set during the LA riots. Yeah, it's exactly as bad as you think it is.
And brilliantly, he even pitched another Shakespeare play. He pitched a version of Titus Andronicus set in space, including, and I quote, an erotic scene of ectoplasmic sex. Which, don't know about you guys, I've definitely been flyered for on the Royal Mile during the Edinburgh Fringe.
But my favourite memory from that podcast is a play that we have here. It's The Moose Murders by Arthur Bicknell. Now, the script is published by Samuel French, an imprint of Concord Theatricals, who happened to also publish a play called Vespertilio, written by me. So clearly they've got excellent taste. The summary of The Moose Murders is as follows. The wealthy heirs of a wealthy but ailing old man named Sidney Holloway have purchased the Wild Moose Lodge in the Adirondacks as a place for Daddy to live out his last days. And they play a game of murder suggested by one of the clan, but one of them is really murdered for real. And who done it? Could it have been the legendary Butcher Moose, which haunts the mountains, or a member of the family itself? With a summary like that, of course, is a Texas oil baron who found the script worth investing in. He agreed to produce it. The play's director, a first-timer called John Roach, cast his wife, Lily Robertson, in it. To this day, it remains her only Broadway credit, and Roach's only Broadway directing credit. And it had 13 previews before it opened on Broadway, one of them with Eve Arden in the lead. Now, Eve Arden was a proper famous actress. She was Oscar nominated for a role in Mildred Pierce. Hadn't been on Broadway for over 4 decades. And apparently couldn't remember any of her lines and dropped out after that one preview. And the remaining 12, she was replaced by Holland Taylor, whose previous show on Broadway was only 6 years beforehand. Another show which closed after just one night, as The Moose Murders would go on to do. It opened in the Eugene O'Neill Theatre on February 22nd, 1983. And we have a couple of reviews. The New York Post's Clive Barnes...
So indescribably bad that I do not intend to waste anyone's time by describing it.
And New Yorker art critic Brendan Gill.
The play would insult the intelligence of an audience consisting entirely of amoebas.
And Arthur Bicknell said that a member of the public, when they saw him in the street, shouted, "Officer, arrest that show." There's a quote from Holland Taylor, the actress who replaced Eve Arden, which Beck's going to read.
The play closes on a blackout laugh line, which is my line. One night, I said the line. It got its fairly weak response, and the lights did not go out, and the curtain did not come down. And that was the end of the play. The others all started scattering like rats on the ship. I said, "Come back here!" and made them all come back, and we stood in a line, took hands, and bowed. And I said... That is the end of the play.
Now, in fairness, Arthur Bicknell did write a book, Moose Murdered, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love My Broadway Bomb. He didn't learn to love it enough for his publisher to fucking give us the rights to read any of it tonight. But they don't own the rights to Frank Rich's New York Times review of the original production.
Oh, which Ben is going to read.
Yeah, in a 13-year career as a stand-up comedy comedian, I have never got to read anyone else's reviews out on stage, and I'm really going to enjoy doing this. From now on, there will always be two groups of theatre-goers in this world, those who have seen Moose Murders and those who have not. Those of us who have witnessed the play that opened that night will undoubtedly hold periodic reunions in the noble tradition of survivors of the Titanic. The set is profusely decorated with the requisite stuffed moose heads. Though the heads may be hunting trophies, one cannot rule out the possibility that these particular moose committed suicide shortly after being shown the script that trades on their good name. The cast are a whole crowd of unappetizing clowns. The wealthy Hedda Holloway, the lodger's new owner, arrives with her husband, Sydney, a heavily bandaged quadriplegic who is confined to a wheelchair and who is accurately described as that fetid roll of gauze. The Holloway children, including Stinky, a drug-crazed hippie who wants to sleep with his mother, for much of Act One, this ensemble stumbles about mumbling dialogue that, as far as one can tell, is only improved by its inaudibility. I'm tempted to upbraid the author, director and producer of Moose Murders, but surely the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals will be after them soon enough.
We have a challenge for our guests based on another thing we talked about during that episode. Unstageable stage directions. As a playwright, I love avoiding stage directions, but there are some writers who like to stick in stage directions seemingly to piss off the director. So we have three for each of you, which they haven't seen up to this point. Obviously, this is an audio medium for our listeners at home. So we have some equipment, mainly garnered from Ben's child's play box. And our guests are going to do Wait. Some Foley work based on the stage direction we're going to give them instead. Jay's stage direction is from Gary Owen's Cancer Time. What time is it?
I think I've got a third of them in here.
Okay. The stage direction is, they sit, and gradually the day turns to night. They sit, and gradually the summer turns to winter. They sit, and gradually the city disappears beneath grass and wild flowers. They sit, and gradually the buildings all crumble to the ground. Now sit with that for a while, Jay. We'll give you some time, don't worry. Rhea's stage direction is from Sarah Kane's Cleansed. A couple make love. A sunflower bursts from the floor and grows above their heads. And Bex is four words long. It's from The Royal Hunt of the Sun by Peter Schaffer, and it is, they cross the Andes. Again, we're going to give you a minute or two to think about those while we tell you a couple of things from a couple of stagings of Macbeth. Ben told us about a rival Macbeth that took place in America in the 1840s. William Charles Macready of England and Edwin Forrest of the US staged competing Macbeths on Broadway in 1849. And an audience, they had like proper fans who did not like their opponents. So an audience of Forrest fans threw fruit and chairs at Macready at the Astor Palace, at the Astor Place Opera House, disrupting the show and starting a riot. The militia was called in and fired on the crowd. More than 20 died and another 30 plus were injured, which nearly topped the death toll in the play itself.
And then in a 1953 outdoor production in Bermuda starring Charlton Heston, during the attack on Macbeth's castle, a gust of wind blew smoke and flames into the audience, who naturally fled. Earlier in the show, Heston was riding a horse bareback around the East Fort's ramparts and suddenly rushed off stage, pointing at his tights, writhing in pain and yelling, "Get them off me!" According to the actor's autobiography, whoever had laundered his tights had dipped them in kerosene, and the sweat of the horse and the heat caused serious burns to Charlton Heston's legs and groin. And honestly, guys, it couldn't happen to a nicer man.
From my warm on fire hands.
So.
Can I ask a quick question?
You can.
So we have a bag full of your children's toys.
Yes.
What do they do with the ricer?
Make rice, duh.
Wow.
So we're going to get you guys to perform your stage directions. I'll remind you all of them before each of our performers does it. And it's a point for the most evocative stage direction as determined by our audience.
Would it be cheating if I used the guitar that happens to be by my leg?
Jay, you do what you like. This really doesn't matter.
All right. Would it be cheating if I got an audience member to help me as well? You happen to be the closest to me geographically. What's your name?
Alex.
Alex, could you do me a massive favor? And like, while I'm doing my bit on the guitar, could you hold all five of these objects. This one too, yeah. And then on my signal, when I nod, can you sort of drop them gradually to the ground? Yeah. The more gradually, the better, because that seems to be the most important word here.
Okay. And do you want to read the stage direction as you go, Jay, or will I?
Yes, please.
Okay, fine.
They sit, and gradually, the day turns to night. They sit, and gradually, the summer turns to winter.
By the way, this music I'm playing is general passage of time type music.
Yeah.
They sit, and gradually the city disappears beneath grass and wildflowers. They sit, and gradually the buildings all crumble to the ground.
It's good.
Okay, Rhea up next. This is British Enfant Terrible Sarah Kane's play Cleansed.
Yes, remind them what it says and then I'll do it.
It is, a couple make love, a sunflower bursts from the floor and grows above their heads.
Oh, look at that flower.
I'll plant what she's planting.
Beck,
I swear to God, Beck, if you say, oh, look, the Andes, I will kill you.
Beck has gone down into the audience to whisper to somebody.
I mean, I believe what she's whispering to him is, can you do an impersonation of 100,000 Incan tribesmen and three llamas?
Beck is dragging her mic the whole lot.
Okay, can you read the line, please?
Yes.
Right.
They cross the Andes.
Ooh.
Ah. Oh!
I need to clarify that those three men are called Andy.
Well done on breathing genuinely fresh life into an old joke. That is glorious.
We're just going to have to do it by shouting out, which, I mean, they're all brilliant, but we do need to award some points at some point. So on three, if you liked Jay, best shout Jay. If you liked Rhea's, best shout Rhea. If you liked Beck, best shout Beck. And we will arbitrarily decide which of you has been shouted for most. I know they're all good, but what are artists without judgment and prizes?
Take a moment to remind you that they did clearly say it was about evocativeness.
Yes, evocative. Yeah. Very true. So on three,
I don't know if you heard some of those oohs from the end.
I did, but none of them resulted in a flower. So every woman in the room here knows.
No one you can see.
So Jay, Rhea, or Beck on three. One, two, three.
Jay!
Ooh. You know what? I think it's two for Beck and a point each for the other two. I'm going to call it there. I don't care. I'm being Alex Horn and Greg Davies in this moment. Yep. They're winning a fucking wooden spoon. What do you care about? Don't
yeah. Marvellous. A round of applause for everyone. Yeah, very good.
Right, friends. For you, Andes.
Yeah. Yes, currently in the lead are the three Andes. We talked about the world's worst poet, of course. As we are gathered here today, we need a little bit of poetry with our friend and fellow podcaster, Izzy Lawrence. And we decided upon a gentleman called Theophilus Marzials. But I would like to give a brief honourable mention to the Canadian cheese poet, James McIntyre. I read now from his great work, Oxford Cheese Ode. The ancient poets ne'er did dream that Canada was the land of cream. They ne'er imagined it could flow in this cold land of ice and snow, where everything did solid freeze. They ne'er hoped or looked for cheese. And the thing about James McIntyre is that he wrote literally thousands of poems like that, all about cheese.
But we have a challenge for our three performers here, and they're to read three poems by other poets we've discussed on the podcast. They are all poems about tragedies and disasters, so you're getting a point for the most moving performance, whether that is, you know, making us cry or making the audience move towards the exits. We're going to start with Rhea, who's going to read us The Great Chicago Fire, an abridged version of The Great Chicago Fire by Julia Ann Moore, not that one, who one critic said of her, Shakespeare, could he read her work, would be glad that he was dead. initially she was oblivious to how bad some of her poetry was, but she started doing public performances and realised that people had just come to laugh at her when she was selling out these places and everyone was pointing and laughing. And so at the end of one show she said, you've come here and paid 25 cents to see a fool. I receive $75 and see a whole house full of fools. So,
oh, well, I don't know about you guys, but I've done gigs where I've died and said that. Absolutely.
So,
she
Rhea,
played to a room of 300 people. Like, we dream of that.
Yeah.
Shut up, Rhea. There's 300 people in this room. It's an audio medium. So The Great Chicago Fire, Rhea, okay. If you would, and audience, anyone who cries or, you know, feel a tear welling, do give us a wave.
I'm going to do my best. All right, here we go. The Great Chicago Fire. The Great Chicago Fire, friends, will never be forgot. In the history of Chicago, it will remain a darkened spot. It was a dreadful, horrid sight to see that city in flames. But no human aid could save it, for all skill was tried in vain. In the year of 1871, in October on the 8th, the people in that city then was full of life and great. Less than 4 days it lay in ruins, that garden city so great, lay smoldering in ashes in a sad and pitiful state. Some people were very wealthy. On the morning of the 10th, what did they loot? What's going on? But at the close of the evening, was poor but felt content. Glad to escape from harm with life, with friends they loved so well. Some will try to gain more wisdom by the sad sight they beheld. With the sky as their covering, pillows they had none. Sad, oh sad it must have been for those poor homeless ones. Neighboring cities sent comfort to the poor lone helpless ones, and God will not forget them in all the years to come. Well, they're with him, aren't they? That's why he won't forget them. They're up there next door going, hey, God, why'd you kill our city? Okay. Now the city of Chicago is built up anew once more, and may it never be visited with such a great fire no more. I thought she didn't want anyone to go to Chicago.
My favorite part of that is the bit where she says, pillows, they had none. Like, that's the worst thing. Soft furnishings in the 1880s.
My favorite bit is the double negative in that last line, which is, may it never be visited with such a great fire no more. So you want it to be this.
Yeah, that is absolutely the poem of a known arsonist.
Yeah.
Next, we are going to go to a name that I'm sure a lot of you will recognise, probably the most infamous bad poet of all time, William Topaz McGonagall. He was a Scottish poet of Irish descent, and at one point he found lucrative work performing his poetry at a circus in Dundee. He would come out into the middle of the circus, read his poems, while the crowd were permitted to pelt him with eggs, flour, potatoes, stale bread, and herrings. He was then served at a Michelin star restaurant later that day. He received 15 shillings for the pleasure of doing that, and his most infamous poem commemorates the collapse of the railway bridge over the River Tay in 1879. And he actually wrote three poems about the Tay bridges. The first one, written before the disaster begins, Beautiful Railway Bridge of the Silvery Tay, which is the same as the opening line of the second one we hear about. The third poem, written on the opening of the new bridge to replace the collapsed one, begins, Beautiful New Railway Bridge of the Silvery Tay. Anyway, we are handing over to Jay on this one to embody the majestic work of Mr. McGonagall with the Tay Bridge Disaster.
Beautiful Railway Bridge of the Silvery Tay. Alas, I am very sorry to say that 90 lives have been taken away on the last Sabbath day of 1879. Which will be remembered for a very long time. And many of the passengers with fear did say, I hope God will send us safe across the Bridge of Tay. But when the train came to near Warmit Bay, Boreas he did loud and angry bray. and shook the central girders of the Bridge of Tay on the last Sabbath day of 1879. Which will be remembered for a very long time. So the train moved slowly along the Bridge of Tay until it was about midway. Then the central girders, with a crash, gave way. And down went the train and passengers into the Tay. The storm fiend did loudly bray, because 90 lives had been taken away.
When were they taken away, Jay?
On the last Sabbath day of 1879, which will be remembered for a very long time. I must now conclude my lay by telling the world fearlessly, without the least dismay, that your central girders would not have given way, at least many sensible men do say, had they been supported on each side with buttresses. At least many sensible men confesses, for the stronger we our houses do build, the less chance we have of being killed.
Bit of structural engineering advice from McGonagall there at the end.
Can I just say, I wouldn't vote for me after that.
No, yeah.
I don't hold it against you, but my poem was nowhere near as good as that.
That is remarkable.
I mean, we haven't heard Beck's yet. But.
Who knew how many things rhymed with Tay? And yet he uses the word Tay so many times. But the winner of that episode was Theophilus Marzials, and we're going to hear his poem A Tragedy very shortly from Beck. He was a British composer, singer, and poet, which I believe is the 1800s version of comedian and YouTuber. And he worked as an assistant librarian in the British Museum reading room, where he would walk around with his long, curly, flowing locks saying, "Am I not the darling of the British Museum reading room?" while everyone else was quietly reading. And his only published collection of poems was released in 1873, called The Gallery of Pigeons and Other Poems. But this poem, A Tragedy, which we often refer to as merely the word plop, because it's about a friend cheating on his girlfriend, cheating on him with a friend of his. But the word plop turns up a lot more times you would think should. So Beck, feel free to grace us.
Okay. But because plop does show up in a lot, I'm going to get the audience to help me, if that's okay. So every time I do this, can you all say plop?
So in the manner of Blackadder saying bob.
Yeah, give it a nice... Okay, so we'll just practice as a group. Oh, that's enjoyable. That's my new alarm. Okay. I have IBS, I'm well used to that sound. All right, we'll start. A tragedy. Death!
Flop!
The barge is down in the river, flop, flop,
flop.
Above, beneath. From the slimy branches, the grey drips drop as they scraggle black on the thin grey sky, where the black cloud rack hackles, dizzle and fly. I love those guys. They've got a good album. Great stuff. To the oozy waters that lounge and flop on the black scrag piles where the loose cords as the raw wind winds in the thin tree top and scudding by the boatmen call out hoy and hey. All is running water and sky, and my head shrieks stop, and my heart shrieks die, and I stand and start at the water that oozes up,
blah.
And
blah.
Oh my gosh, there's another page. On the barges that flop, well, they love flop, don't they? They know it goes, they know what goes with it. On the barges that flop and the dizzy me dead, I might reel and drop dead. And the shrill wind whines in the thin tree top, flop. A curse on him, ugh, yet I knew. If a woman is false, can a friend be true? It was only a lie from the beginning to end. My devil, my friend. I had trusted the whole of my living to... Ah! I knew! Ah!
So what do I care? And my head is empty as air. I can do, I can dare. The barges flop, drip, drop. I can dare, I can dare. And let myself all run away with my head. Like, what would you do without it? And let myself run away with my head and stop, drop, dead.
Flop.
Flop.
And amazingly, I have to tell you that Beck's rendition there was an abbreviated version of that poem.
He left in all the plops, though.
Yeah, he did.
I think based on applause, I think Jay's rendition nailed that. So two points to Jay, 1 point to everyone else.
Can I just ask, what was that about? What was the tragedy of the plop?
Plop, I think you're fine. Yeah.
I think a girlfriend broke up with him or cheated on him with a friend. But I think maybe he just had heard the word plop for the first time at the same time. It was like, onomatopoeia? Wow, I hardly know her.
And she cheated on me.
We are going to talk about superheroes. And when Beck joined us way back in like our second episode, we talked about terrible superheroes that appeared in lots of comic books and films. We talked about the likes of, these are all genuine, none of these are fakes, by the way. Arm fall off, boy. Matter eater lad. The almighty dollar, whose real name was J. Pennington Pennypacker. Chartered accountant by day, the job of my father, who's sitting in the audience at the moment, who by night was a superhero, could shoot pennies from his hands.
Oh boy, do we have a big reveal for you at the end of the show. Yeah.
The fiddler, who channels his magic powers through his violin.
Sure he does.
Yeah. Typeface. A sign maker who literally throws letters at his enemies. And his sidekick, Spellcheck. And my favourite ones, Stiltman and Lady Stiltman. Who had telescopic legs but was beaten by Deadpool when he took a manhole cover off a manhole and she fell in. But Beck, I believe you've got some other terrible superheroes of your own for us.
So on our episode, we did Worst X-Men. Mm. And so I thought as a new thing for the listeners, I would follow that up with the Worst Avengers lineup. So I've got 10 here. We'll start with Cat Payne America.
Strap in, guys. She said she has 10 of these.
It's just imagine Chris Evans with a cat attacking his face constantly. You know that really funny sound effect they always use? There's always a rawr, like in the, it's just that constantly. Iron Mum. Just like a mum instead of Tony Stark in the suit, and she just flies around after all the fights, having a go at everyone for leaving the place in such a mess. The Incredible Hull. All the population of Hull get together like a Megazord. And the only reason it's the worst one is the costume is very expensive. It's very big. Black Widow. Black Widow, she blagged her way into the Avengers. In fact, they don't even know if she's a widow. I can't believe anything she says. Cider-Man, who was bitten by a radioactive apple. And his, of course, his sidey senses are tingling, which is usually just because he's had far too much Scrumpy Jack. I'm not sure I didn't come up with anything for this one, just the name. You can do the rest. Falcon in the Middle. Then there's Warm Machine, which is just a warm machine. That's all it is. I realise I got 11 because I forgot one. Thaw, which is spelled T-H-A-W. Tends to work with warm machine. This makes everything slightly warm. Yeah. Scarlett Johansson Witch. Just thought I'd join them up, basically. That's all I've done there. Hawkeye. It's one of the worst ones, I'm sorry. There's no joke there, it's just the real one. And Ant-Man, but I think you'll find that over here in Australia we pronounce it Ant-Man. who has a suit that makes him the same size as an auntie. It's not much use because he sort of stays the same size most of the time. Yeah, so that was it. That's the worst Avengers. There you go.
So that sort of segues beautifully into what we're going to talk about next, which is the world's worst fan fiction. You have sort of written the cast list for a future Avengers fan fiction. And we spoke to a gentleman called Andrew Schaffer, who managed to get to like the top of the New York Times bestsellers list yes. with a piece of fan fiction he wrote about Barack Obama and Joe Biden, not as lovers, as I'm so sorry, I know, but as a pair of crime-fighting buddy cops.
Yeah, it's Hope Never Dies, and the sequel Hope Rides Again. we looked on fanfiction.net. In 2016, it had 40,000 Star Wars fanfiction stories. And 743,000 Harry Potter fan fiction stories.
And every single one of them is problematic.
Yeah.
And we are now going to do a small reading for you, or our guests are, from one of the 743,000 possible Harry Potters, Hogwarts School of Prayer and Miracles. And it is written by an anonymous author known only on the internet as Proud Housewife, all small letters.
Yeah, we have Jay performing the role of Hagrid, Beck as Harry, and Rhea as Aunt Petunia. This is from the first chapter, so if anyone knows the Harry Potter, it's from the very first film or book.
Good morning, kiddo. My name is Hagrid.
Is that all right, by the way?
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're still doing French, right?
My name is Hagrid. Can I speak to your mummy and daddy?
I don't have a mummy or a daddy.
I am so sorry to hear that.
You can speak with my auntie and uncle.
What do you want?
Hello, neighbour. I was wondering if you've been saved.
Saved?
Is Hagrid wearing a suit?
Saved? Ah, don't tell me you're one of those Christians.
Yes, I am. Are you?
We are too smart for that. Haven't you read Dawkins? God is dead. Dawkins proved that. Would you like us to educate you on the Dawkins?
The Dawkins.
I like Dawkins a house elf.
What is a Christian?
Christians are people who want to be good. We want to go to heaven after we die. Do you know what heaven is, Harry?
You know, thank you so much for your concern, sir, but he does not need your religion. He has science and socialism and birthdays. Haven't you heard of evolution?
My stage direction, by the way, says laughing wisely.
Evolution is a fairy tale. You don't really believe that, do you?
Yes, I do, and so does Dawkins, my house elf. He wears his socks under his selfish jeans.
To get to this heaven place?
All you have to do is be saved. Do you want to be saved?
I do, I do.
You're a Christian now, Harry.
I'm a what?
You're a Christian. Well, speaking as the podcast Jewish representative, I am convinced.
Yeah. As a podcast Christian representative, I just want to say that this is incorrect. Everyone knows the right way to get into heaven is you have to run really fast into a platform wall. Just really believe in it. Technically, I'm not wrong. If you run hard enough...
So we have a challenge based on fanfiction. We've asked our guests to bring in their own short 5 to 7 lines of fanfiction.
Okay, so like full disclosure, I had to call Ben today and go, "Hi Ben, what's fanfiction?" And he gave me an explanation where he said you kind of rewrite something to be the way you wanted it to be. So I rewrote backstage at the Tory party conference.
Oh, we're going to get so badly sued.
And then I got here and you all went, yeah, with a sexual element. I went, oh, fuck, okay. Boris paced nervously backstage. This was it. This was his big moment. The speech to end the conference. The speech to end all speeches.
"Build back, Burt Bacharach," he muttered to himself. "No," he thought, "that doesn't scan." Suddenly, two small, soft, almost illegally young hands encircled his waist from behind. Phew, he thought for a second he was having a Prince Andrew moment, but it was just his wife. "Carrie," he said, untangling himself from her embrace, "please, I need to focus. I just wanted to let you know that Dr. Seuss wishes you the best of luck with the speech," she said quietly, in case anyone heard. No one could know that Dr. Seuss didn't die and was actually secretly writing speeches for the Prime Minister from his, from his small, discreet retreat down at number 7 Downing Street. "Ah, of course," said Boris. "Send him my best. Tell him that the raucous squawkus from the Antiochus caucus was inspired." "I will do," she whispered, adjusting his tie and giving him a quick peck on the lips. "But for now, it's showtime. Go on, honey. Knock him dead with your resignation speech. Trust me, the nation will love it." And with those words of encouragement speeding him on his way, he turned and walked out to face the cacophonous conference crowd.
That was tremendous.
And Jay?
I've done a Harry Potter one.
Of course you have.
Does it count if I was stoned off my tits when I wrote it?
I think it counts double.
All right, well, so this story is called Harry Potter and the Blarg. And by the way, Blarg is spelt with 10 A's. So here it is. "Are you all right, Harry?" asked Hermione. "Yes," Harry lied. "Are you sure?" said Hermione in a concerned way. "Yes," said Harry. "I'm all right." But he wasn't. Hermione looked concerned. "Are you sure you're all right, Harry?" she said. Harry answered her. "Yes, I'm all right." But he was lying. Hermione thought that he wasn't all right, despite the fact that he was saying that he was. "Are you really sure you're all right, Harry?" she asked. Again, with concern. Harry considered the question, but decided not to answer truthfully. "Yes," he lied, "I'm all right." Then they were eaten by the Blarg.
Good luck, Beck.
"Beck was my favourite act tonight," said Barry, as he...
I will remind you, my father is in the audience.
"As he stacked up the final row of chairs at the backyard comedy club. I thought everyone was good," said Ben diplomatically. Barry rolled his eyes. "Mate, everyone's gone home. You don't have to spare anyone's feelings. Just be honest." "I am being honest," insisted Ben, tucking a loose curl behind his ear. "No," shouted Barry. "I'm sick of you fighting me on every little detail." "Oh, Bazza, this isn't fighting," said Ben. He tightened his grip on the chair he was holding. "This is fighting." He hurled the chair at Barry's soft face. Barry instinctively roundhouse kicked the collapsible seat out of the air. Spy Break began to play, which is that track from The Matrix. When Neo and Trinity shoot all those security guards in the foyer, which is a really cool scene until you realise that to anyone living in the Matrix, it's an unprovoked mass shooting. Also, they'd already established that if you die in the Matrix, you die in real life, so regardless of whether the security guards' perceptions of reality were correct, Neo and Trinity still very much murdered a bunch of people in real life. But hey, cool track, right? So anyway, Barry unsheathed his katana.
If anyone doesn't know what a katana is, it's a weapon. Have I made it any better?
in brackets I've written, not a euphemism. Bring it on, he said, striking a badass pose. Not so fast, said Ben. He pointed at his nunchucks, which dangled from his shorts. Totally a euphemism. Ah, my eyes, cried Barry, who was temporarily blinded by the sight of Ben's elongated bollocks poking out. Poking out from his leg sleeve, or whatever you call the sleeve equivalent of a pair of shorts or trousers. I genuinely don't know what it is. Barry regained his vision and swooshed the katana around in an impressive display of dexterity and strength. He even cut a lingering coronavirus in half. Ben swooshed the chair around in an awkward display of chair waving. The pair locked eyes. To be continued.
I mean, if I give you 2 points, will you promise never to continue it?
Is what Barry said. 2 points, totally a euphemism.
I think that's 2 points all around. I can't separate those. They were all brilliant. Very, very good. Rhea, when she came on the show, didn't talk to us about a literary topic per se. Rhea talked to us instead about the world's worst legal defence. What better way to cool ourselves down after all of that sauciness with a bit of lawyer speak?
Yeah, so what I thought I would do is combine the old childhood game of, what's this called, the foldy paper thing? Chatterbox? Yeah, all right. We're going to do a chatterbox of the best legal defenses, and I'll let you know whether they worked or not, but there's a whole bunch out there that have genuinely been used in court. Oh, what was your name?
Rosie.
Rosie, pick a number.
Seven.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 5, or 6?
6.
6, okay. That is the taxi driver defense. Okay, this has been used in court. I know you're thinking, how can you use being a taxi driver's defense? It is not about the job. It's about the movie. Literally, John Hinckley Jr. Was so obsessed with Jodie Foster in the movie Taxi Driver that he shot Ronald Reagan. Now, I haven't seen the movie. I don't get how the two are connected. I'm not quite sure how you get obsessed with a teenage prostitute and go, I must kill the president, but there must have been something.
I think he did it to try and impress her.
Yeah, I think it was, to gain her attention.
Right.
But yes. She certainly did.
In his head, he was completely and utterly playing out the role of Travis Bickle, who was played by De Niro in the movie. And so his lawyers went, well, we're going to use the taxi driver defense. This is going to make us rich. It's going to work for years to come to get him off... of the attempted assassination of the president.
I think thank God that he used that De Niro movie and it didn't occur 20 years later and he'd have to use the Rocky and Bullwinkle defense.
Right, well, do you think it worked?
Oh.
That's the question here. Did this work?
I think he's in prison still, isn't he? I think.
No, he was found not guilty by reason of insanity, but he is still incarcerated in a mental hospital. All right, should we do another one?
Yeah.
Pick a number. 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Look at that one-handed chatterbox. I know, right? I know. Oh, okay, so 1, 2, or 5?
5.
5 is affluenza. Affluenza as a defense, right? Ethan Couch was driving along drunk on a restricted license. And along the side of the road was two people whose car had broken down and two more people who were helping. He crashed into all four of them and killed them. His defense, come up with by his lawyers, was affluenza. Basically, his parents were so rich that he was not taught that actions have consequences, but that wealth buys privilege, and therefore he did not understand that what he did was wrong. Did it get him off murder?
Yes, because he's rich.
It did. It dropped him down to rehab in a very expensive facility that had to be paid for by his parents, and then a 10-year probation. So if he kept clean for 10 years, he'd get off of it. But then he went, fuck this shit, and ran off to Mexico, which immediately landed him in jail.
Yeah.
Oh, what a happy ending. Yeah.
Thank goodness, though, right?
Yeah.
Thank goodness. Do you do one more?
One more.
All right, one more. Hello.
Holly.
Hi, Holly. Holly, I'm going to just... We'll go with the other side of the chatterbox. Do you want 3, 4, 7, or 8?
Let's go 7.
Let's go 7. I like you. Prime numbers. Nice. Okay. This is the computer chip defense. In 1993, Colin Ferguson basically went and fired into a crowd. He killed 6 of them. He injured 19 of them. They cooked up a defense which is tried often in the States, which was kind of like I was blinded by racism, oops, my bad, defense, which has been used before. There's also like the gay panic defense. He then went, no, I don't like that. And you go, oh, maybe, you know, not as bad a guy as we thought he was. Turns out, no. So he fired his lawyers. He then represented himself in order to be able to interview all of the witnesses and pull his own, you know, call his own witnesses and everything else. He then called a witness who concurred with him that a government had put a computer chip in his head. Did it work as a defense?
No, bollocks. Surely not.
No, he got a 315-year prison sentence. At all. Did not work at all.
Did they give him that long a prison sentence just in case there was a computer chip in his head and that's how long it takes for it to degrade?
No, but because of the computer chip, that's why they put him in like a room with glass walls inside a concrete room.
We're nearly at the exciting climax of the show, which means it's time to talk about the world's worst sex scene. I'm so sorry, Dad, for what's about to happen next.
I am so delighted about what's going to happen, Mr. McStay.
On the world's worst sex scene episode, we had Tristan Bernays, playwright Tristan Bernays, talk to us about various sex scenes. And we chose a scene from Morrissey's novel, List of the Lost, which I have a copy of, and I want to make very clear I bought on eBay and did not buy directly from the right-wing shithead that Morrissey is, who makes a great case for the queer community having an entrance exam. So yeah, Ben, what did The Guardian write about this novel?
So Michael Mann, who wrote in The Guardian, said, "Do not read this book. Do not sully yourself with it, no matter how temptingly brief it seems. It is an unpolished turd of a book, the stale excrement of Morrissey's imagination. Please don't encourage Morrissey to write any more novels."
It is genuinely, my husband sat watching me skim read this and like scoffing every second sentence. But the blurb on the back of the novel... You know, there's a bit of writing. Then at the bottom it says, Morrissey. Like, it's a profound quote from somebody else, but it's on his book. And it reads a little bit like a terrible Smith song. So, you know, hang on, Morrissey voice. Beware the novelist. Intimate and indiscreet, an American tale where naturally evil conquers good. List of the Lost is the reality of what is true, battling against what is permitted to be true.
Sorry, is that Morrissey or a Greek Orthodox priest?
I can only do an impression of him when he's singing. I can't do Morrissey speaking. The challenge for our guests is to read some of the sex scenes from this novel. One person will read a section, while the other two must provide appropriate or inappropriate sound effects. And I've just had a look at the scores.
Andy, get ready.
Yeah. I already did mine earlier,
yeah.
Okay?
I just looked at the scores. Beck has 5 points, Shea has 5 points, Rhea has 4, but we are marking this out of 10. Ooh. 10 inches.
Rendering so the previous rounds obsolete.
Yes. The audience are going to judge which reader best manages to keep their focus and best manages to make the scene in any way sexy or indeed comprehensible. Jay, I'm so sorry, you're the first lemming over the cliff.
Okay. By now, Ezra would head up the mountain at will, whilst Eliza was always quite happy with bed and breakfast.
Yum, yum.
Eliza was a fierce grabber, which was another first for Ezra, who had only known gentle intention. Eliza barged in intemperately, kicking
Pardon
up.
She has a very low voice.
Kicking up heels and kicking up a racket. And
try playing squash with that!
And even here now, Ezra secured a particular teamwork, all meat and potatoes, nuts and bolts.
How you like them apples?
Eliza drove with no brakes, as if supplies were dwindling. As if the seven-year-old within couldn't quite believe what it was that lay beside her, or how much happiness she brought to his eyes by doing what she thought to be nothing at all.
Oh, God, they are having sex. I didn't get that.
I know. It's so hidden.
That
isn't even in it. It would have made it so much clearer if it was.
Oh. Okay, keep your eyes on me, not the 7-year-old next to me.
Yeah.
That's the appropriate sound.
The locked position when Ezra rubbed as far as he could go.
No, stop. No, that's it.
The hump and bump of injection.
Ow, too far.
As his eyes met hers in equal swirl. Guts and innards finally melting with intellect as jets of Ezra would cut in and then cut off at that moment when all of the body is felt from tip to toe. The inside works just as well as the outside.
Ugh. Has Morrissey ever had sex? Question to the group. Rhea, enjoy.
With playful nastiness, Eliza twists her entire body as she pulls away, knowing that this will cause a neatly burning pain to Ezra. Who paused a moment to tell the monkey to go away. Which amuses her because it brings to Ezra's face a new expression. Like inhaling a cigarette. That face. That face, that landscape. How could he see his own reflection every single day and not feel blessed?
Oh?
Jim the Tall Man Taylor.
They pause again and tell the gorilla to follow the monkey. Eliza's sudden twist is an awakening hurt, unlike their earlier tit-for-tat punch-ups.
Oh, I want boobies.
After which Ezra falls flatly on his front. Pinned on the rack like a sailor receiving the last with a wordless intoxication as a light wave of the hand gives Eliza the all-passion-spent tip-off.
Thank you.
She could, of course, make further demands, but enough had taken place. The mutual head rush struck both of them at the same time. As a man and woman lightning bolt that meant... nice. That meant they could now lounge together at the end of it, yet saying nothing. Because the air around their silence crashed and gargled with... with so much meaning.
Holy moly. All right. Is anybody still got genitals? Mine have dissipated. Beck, please finish us off, so to speak.
Eliza and Ezra rolled together in the one giggling snowball of full-figured copulation, screaming and shouting,
ow!
As they playfully bit and pulled at each other in a dangerous and clamorous roller coaster coil of sexually oh my gosh, this is one sentence. Yeah. A clamorous roller coaster coil of sexually violent rotation with Eliza's breasts barrel rolled across Ezra's howling mouth. And the pained frenzy of his bulbous salutation extenuating his excitement as it whacked and smacked its way into every muscle of Eliza's body, except for the otherwise central zone. Can I just very quickly say that as one sentence? Yeah. I wanted to give them a chance to do Foley, but they were too, horrified. Yeah.
Also, bulbous salutation just sounds like Ezra's penis is lifting us up and going, good day.
And after that very long sentence, he missed the otherwise central zone, which is sort of where you want to be.
Yeah.
Like, that's a...
It's like a rail replacement bus service in service.
Because I do a lot of like the talking bits at the end of ads that go back to Australia, so I do the terms and conditions bit at the end. So I'm going to try and do that for this.
Yeah, go on.
Eliza and Ezra rolled into one giggling snowball of full-figure copulation, screaming and shouting as they playfully bit and pulled at each other in a dangerous and clamorous rollercoaster coil of sexually violent rotation, with Eliza's breast barrel-rolled across Ezra's howling mouth and pained frenzy of his bulbous salutation extenuating his excitement as it whacked and smacked its way to every muscle of Eliza's body, except otherwise for the central zone. Yeah.
No.
Both fell awkwardly off the bed.
Sorry.
Back.
Each tending to their own anguish, yet still laughing, an impaired discomfort of giggles whilst curving into a hunched disadvantage.
I feel so disadvantaged.
Oh, there's dialogue too.
Yeah.
Cojones are not the most useful accoutrements at times like these. Oh, groaned Ezra, sorry. Yes, I know. I traded mine in at a Tupperware party. I came away with a lovely butter boat that was far more useful and much admired in New Bedford.
Yeah.
Thank
That's
you,
how
yes.
the sex scene ends. I'm going to call it. I think the fact that Beck stunned the other competitors into silence and that bit won the Bad Sex Award, the literary award that they give out in Britain every year. And you got to the end of it, Beck Hill. So I think you are our winner.
I'm the only one that finished in the central zone. Yeah.
So I think that's 10 points and 9 for the other two.
Yeah.
Which means we have a prize for Beck.
Oh, we do.
Beck, you win the Worst Foot Forward wooden spoon. Congratulations.
I don't own a wooden spoon. I'm so happy.
I'm going to make
so many massive chili con carnes with this.
Bring it to a Tupperware party in New Bedford.
what we really should have had is a pair of is a stuffed moose head with wooden spoons for antlers. Yeah. Before we go, we've had sex and it's now bedtime, and we're going to end with some lullabies with our friend, a poet, Dan Simpson. We found that the world's worst lullaby was Brahms' lullaby, but more of that in a moment. First, we're going to go around the world with some lullabies from different countries that are, I think you'll agree, horrifying and bone-chilling. And first of all, Jay is going to lull us to sleep with Nene Nene from Brazil.
Hush, little baby. Cuca is coming to get you. Papa went to the fields. Mama went to work. Black-faced ox, come grab this child who is scared of grimaces.
That child cannot go to McDonald's.
Next up, from Haiti, Ria is going to read us some of Dodo Titit.
Your mama isn't here. She went to the market. Your papa isn't here. He went to the river. If you don't sleep, the crab will eat you.
And now we have two from Iceland. First from Barry.
Bium, bium, bambalo, bambalo, and dilly, dilly, do. My little friend, I lull to rest. But outside a face looms at the window.
Night, night. And finally, and I say this speaking as the father of a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, I whisper the following line to them every single night at about 7:30 p.m. Sleep, you black-eyed pig. Fall into a deep pit of ghosts.
But Ben mentioned our world's worst lullaby was Brahms' lullaby, which, Jay, would you mind just demonstrating? You'll all know it. Yeah, lovely. Go to sleep, da-da-da-da-da-da. All that. Brahms composed, he was working in Hamburg, and he met a lady called Bertha Porubsky, who was the daughter of a Protestant pastor, and they exchanged lots of passionate letters, but it seemed quite unrequited, a lot of this love. And so they drifted apart, and Bertha went on to marry a rich guy called Arthur Faber. And on the occasion of the birth of Bertha's second son, Brahms wrote this lullaby as a vegan lead, Opus 49, number 4, and he sent it to Bertha's husband and wrote, Frau Bertha will realize that I wrote the vegan lead for her little one. She will find it quite in order that while she is singing Hans to sleep, a love song is being sung to her. Bertha used to sing a Viennese song to Brahms when they were in Hamburg together. This newly composed lullaby is a counterpoint to that song. So he gave a present to this guy's kid in which he's basically declaring his love for his wife.
Yeah, that's perfectly normal, natural behaviour for Brahms. And this song was like became really, really successful. And Brahms really hated it that every time, you know, people would take and they'd tinker with, they'd do fan fiction on it, they'd tinker with the music and they'd compose variations. And he complained to his publisher, "Why don't you make an addition in a minor key for naughty or sick children? I'm sure that would help you shift more copies." So Jay is going to play it in a minor key for us.
Can I demonstrate the difference if I play it in a major key first? Good evening, good night with roses covered with cloves. Don't slip under the covers tomorrow morning if God wills you will wake once again. As far as it goes.
Yeah, it's a pretty good scan, yeah.
Do you want to hear how it sounded in a minor key?
Yes, please.
Good evening and good night with roses covered with cloves adorned. Slip under the covers tomorrow morning if God wills you will wake once again.
Who wouldn't want to lull their child to sleep with what sounds like a Ukrainian peasant song?
And that is it, ladies and gentlemen, of the Backyard Comedy Club in Bethnal Green. Thank you so much for joining us for our second ever live show. Thank you especially to our donors on Patreon, without whose support we couldn't do this, and who forced us into doing this. So if you didn't have a good time, you got to blame the 75 people who gave us money to do this.
Thank you as well to Danny and the team at the Backyard for doing this, the brilliant James Hingley, who's recorded this entire show, and of course to our marvellous guests, Jay Foreman. Beck Hill, Rialina, and we're all off to see what happens after I throw a chair at Barry McStay's head. To be continued.